Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. Broadcasting from WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we're traveling across the world with a chicken and going down on the bayou with our friend the crawfish. Journalist Andrew Lawler's new book is Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? You'll see, where humans go, the chicken is never far behind. Then, crawfish king Al Scaramuzza takes us back to his earliest mudbug peddling days, and John Peterson of Swamp Pop provides the perfect drink to wash the whole thing down. So stay tuned for some clucking chickens, some spicy crawfish, and some sweet Cajun pop on this week's Louisiana Eats. Journalist Andrew Lawler is a contributing writer for Science Magazine, whose stories focus on the topics of space, science, and technology. With his new book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the World?, Andrew uses his analytical eye to give us a comprehensive history of the animal that has played a quintessential role in the development of human civilization.
Well, let's step back for a second. You know, most people would know that the domesticated dog came from the wolf, right? But how many people know where the chicken came from? And this is the question I set out to answer. It's not really clear exactly what happened, but what I discovered was that a lot of researchers think that chickens were domesticated not for their meat and not for their eggs. They were domesticated for religious ritual and for cockfighting.
Wow.
And the chicken comes from the red jungle fowl. It's a wild bird that lives in South Asia in bamboo thickets.
Okay. Well, so the red jungle fowl. Tell me a little bit about that creature.
Well, first, the red jungle fowl and the chicken are so close that they're the same species. So in the past 50, 60 years, as populations have increased in South Asia, the native habitat of the red jungle fowl, the result has been that the chickens have been breeding with the red jungle fowl, so the red jungle fowl are no longer quite as wild as they used to be. So there really are probably no pure red jungle fowl left. There's no pure wild chicken left in South Asia. But 60 years ago, there was a push to get better game birds for southern hunters.
Yeah, we just can't get enough pheasant, quail, ducks. How does the chicken figure in?
Well, there wasn't much in the way. Beyond quail, there really weren't many pheasants that lived in the South. So the U.S. government sent Gardner Bump, who was a biologist from New York State, sent him overseas with his wife, and for 20 years, they searched for the perfect game fowl that could be brought to the United States and released, particularly in the South, so that hunters would have more than quail to shoot. So where did he go? He went to the place where you find red jungle fowl. He went to the foothills of the Himalayas, and he spent a good deal of time collecting as many as he could. This is back in the early 1960s. Those were shipped back to the U.S., distributed to game facilities, including several here in Louisiana, and then they were released. Now, almost everywhere they died off. Oh. Possums don't exist in India, and they probably saw a good meal and knew it.
Coyotes.
Right. You name it. You name it. Or disease. We don't really know. But in one place in Georgia, they did survive. And now there is a very small group that remains purebred that exist in, you know, three or four different flocks. And those birds are very important because they may actually have the DNA, the only DNA left of the pure wild chicken.
Well, thank goodness for Gardner Bump and those southern hunters, huh?
Absolutely.
Let's go further back in time. The early 1840s were really a seminal turning point in many ways for the chicken and Europeans and Americans, as I understand it, because at the same time that Charles Dickens is writing A Christmas Carol, that's 1843, and he's exalting the praises of that huge turkey that Scrooge sends off to the Cratchits, Queen Victoria actually wanted chicken for Christmas dinner. How did that happen?
What happened was a British captain came back from China during the Opium Wars when England forced China to open its markets, and he gave to Queen Victoria 7 beautiful chickens. Now, these were not your regular scrawny English chickens. These were large, fluffy, almost furry creatures that seemed impossibly exotic, and Queen Victoria was entranced. So she had an aviary built right there at Windsor Castle, and she and her husband, Albert, would go down and visit these chickens every day, and she loved them, and they became a sensation in England. So people started to copy this. Everybody wanted this exotic chicken. So as ships were coming from China more frequently, people started to buy these chickens at enormous prices, $10,000 for a single chicken.
$10,000 for a chicken?
Yes, yes. They were incredibly exotic. It's hard for us to imagine, but at the time, these were very regal animals and very exotic looking, and it was like a fad. So the prices skyrocketed, and people all over England began to breed these Chinese chickens that were very large and had a lot more meat on them with the English chickens, which were a lot hardier. And by combining the genes of these of the East chicken and the West chicken, we created the modern chicken.
Well, I've just found this whole period of time really, really fascinating. And you really caught me by surprise when you mention in your book that the Irish potato famine even figures into this fancy bubble burst crazy chicken time in Great Britain.
Well, remember I mentioned that Queen Victoria had received this gift of Chinese chickens at Windsor. Well, she sent one of those chickens to Ireland for an agricultural fair in Dublin. And that was taking place in the early 1840s, just as a potato famine was beginning. And that chicken actually won. She won an award, and she gave it to the Lieutenant General of Ireland, who then passed it on to a local Dubliner who began to breed them. And this Dubliner said, you know, if we would only breed these chickens and distribute them to the poor, then people in Ireland wouldn't starve. But no one listened to him. And so by the time the famine had reached its peak and a million or more people had died and a million or more had come to the United States, by that point, it was too late. So after that, the chicken began to be seen as something that actually could help with this threat of famine, which was very real then, as millions of people were flocking to cities and there just wasn't the protein to feed them.
Well, in America, the chicken was also, around this same time, affecting some interesting economic changes. And I'd like for you to tell us about the relationship between the African-American slaves and the chicken.
What I discovered was that in West Africa, the chicken was extremely important 400 and 500 years ago. In fact, it was the chicken, as it entered West Africa, that made possible village life. Suddenly, people could come together, live in large numbers, produce chickens, which provided that necessary protein. And West Africans were very adept at raising chickens, which were also considered quite sacred. They formed an important part of many of their religious rituals. So when slaves were brought from West Africa to the United States, starting in the 1600s, the chicken was something that they were extremely familiar with. Now, by contrast, most of the Europeans didn't really think too much about chickens because they had other things. They had ducks, they had geese, and certainly in the New World, there was the turkey to compete. So chickens were kind of rather unimportant at first. So as a result, the slaves were allowed to keep chickens and raise chickens and even sell those chickens to their masters on plantations. And this turned into quite a business. Beginning in the early 1600s, all the way up into the Civil War, the African Americans were known in places like Virginia as the general chicken merchants, that not just slaves, but also freed blacks were able to travel around and sell chickens and eggs and actually make money. It was one of the only ways that African Americans, particularly in the East, were allowed to engage in the entrepreneurial spirit.
It's just such an interesting story. I love this. So it's slaves and chicken in the South. But in the North, it's Jewish women and chickens.
Yes. So in the late 1800s, New York and other cities were swamped with huge numbers of refugees and immigrants fleeing the pogroms in Eastern Europe. And the Jews that came in were big chicken eaters. And the reason is, of course, that pork was proscribed and that beef was very expensive. before that, there was not much of a market for chicken, or certainly not for chicken meat. And here were millions of people demanding chicken. So as a result, people in the South and the Midwest began to respond to this demand. So you have this very interesting kind of collection of very different peoples. You have the African-Americans in the South. You have rural women, white and black, both in the Midwest and the South, who are very, very poor, looking for a way to make a little extra pin money. And then you have the new railroads that were coming into being that could actually take the chickens from these rural areas to the industrializing North for the first time. And so this is what galvanized the modern chicken.
My gosh, that's so interesting. World War II comes along. Tell us how that rolled.
Well, in the beginning of World War II, the government had to make some tough choices, and beef and pork were consigned to the troops. So everybody else was left with chicken, which at the time was not an ideal food. It was kind of stringy. You tended to keep a chicken around until, if it was a hen, it no longer could lay an egg. And at that point, it was probably pretty old and pretty stringy. And
it's
of course,
the stewing hen.
Exactly, the stewing hen. And for a rooster, when a rooster got too old to do his duty, then he also ended up in the pot.
He's coq au vin.
Exactly. You cook it for a long time. So in World War II, people suddenly didn't have a choice. They had to eat a lot of chicken. So the chicken industry began to spring up. There are lots of new incubation factories that sprang up, and suddenly you have lots of chickens being processed by the millions for the first time. By the end of World War II, the business had passed into the hands not of African Americans and not women, and certainly not the Jews, but instead it was in the hands of mainly white Southern men who decided that this was a business that could boom.
Well, Andrew, we've gone through industrial chicken farming, the horrors of that everybody's well aware of. But today, a lot of kids, I don't think they even know that the chicken is a bird necessarily, because all they know is chicken tenders, you know, whatever the heck the tender is. What do you think the future of the chicken is?
Well, it's not just the kids who don't know that the chicken is a bird. It's also the federal government. Because according to U.S. federal law, the chicken is not an animal if it's grown for food. This is a little shocking that even the pig and even a cow is considered to be an animal, and there are some very minimal standards applied for animal welfare in their case. But if you are growing a chicken for food, there is absolutely no standard that you must be held to. You can't be put in jail for anything you do to a chicken if it's being raised for chicken tenders. Now, that's not true if you're using it for research or even if a chicken is in a circus. There are certain rules that apply. But in this case, I find it quite amazing, given how much the chicken has given us over the millennia, that today we don't even give it the dignity of being an animal.
It's pretty shocking. These particular regulations, how far do they date back, or is it something that was just overlooked?
Well, it was not overlooked. It was the chicken industry not really wanting to be regulated, and they have the political power to prevent any regulations from being put in place. And most people don't know about it. And really, it's not just that the industry is trying to hide what they're doing, although they are. It's also that we, as Americans, are avoiding this whole question. We really would rather not know. And I'm guilty of this. I still eat chicken. I'll still buy that chicken taco, even though I know something more than I want to know about the conditions that most chickens actually live under.
Yeah, that's it's bad news. But luckily today, with farmers markets and with people really caring about the ethical care of animals, we're starting to see a little turnaround with that.
There is, although keep in mind that the chickens that you get, even at your farmer's market, probably are that same industrial chicken that was produced from a Chicken of Tomorrow contest in 1950. And I was dragged kicking and screaming into this topic because I didn't know much about chickens, but I've discovered that there are a wonderful way to learn about who we are as a people. That where humans and civilization go, there goes the chicken.
Well, my goodness, Andrew. At this point, all I can say is thank God for the chicken. And thank you so much for coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Absolutely. It was great fun. Thank you.
Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World?
Hey, chicken, you're out talk.
we come back from a short break, we've got the king of crawfish, Al Scaramuzza. Al's in rare form, so you don't want to miss this. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. If you grew up with a love of crawfish in New Orleans, it's likely that you have Al Scaramuzza to thank. Al Scaramuzza is the undeniable king of crawfish. Television commercials for his store, Seafood City, dominated the airwaves for years in New Orleans, and Al was always the star.
Tell him, dear.
Dr. Scaramuzza, we have been trying to have children for many years. Can you help us?
Take this prescription, my dear, for 3 pounds of crawfish for 15 days. You should have many children.
Oh, thank you so much, doctor.
Great!
Seafood City!
Recently, we caught up with Al to hear the story of how he became crawfish king.
Hi, this is Al Scaramuzza. I think most of you guys know me. Stay with Al Scaramuzza, you'll never be a loser. And I'm famous for crawfish. I don't know how many people you know that eat crawfish, but just about everybody that lives in Louisiana eat them. However, years ago, not very many people ate them. In fact, if 1% of the population ate them, that was plenty. In 1950, I'm about 100 years old. In 1950, I'm the guy that brought crawfish to New Orleans. I'm the guy that marketed crawfish. 99% of the people in New Orleans did not know what really crawfish were or are at that time. In fact, it was considered then as a trash food. People used it to, like, catch fish, bait, etc. However, me being a very indigent child growing up, I am a Depression baby. I was born in the time of Depression. And food was hard to get. And so help me God, if you ate crawfish then, you were lucky. And the way it used to happen is actually in the neighborhoods, I could remember this, a very small child, 8, 9 years old, that people in the neighborhood would get together, 3 or 4 guys, and go out in the swamps, which now is a really intricate part of New Orleans, off of where actually I have 3 houses in that vicinity. New Gentilly, it was all swampland. And old Gentilly, old swampland, people used to go there and just fish crawfish. Most people didn't know how to eat them or cook them. But we learned how to do it because we were very poor and very hungry. I got into business in 1949, In 1950, I had a little food stand and a grocery, part of a grocery store, and I sold some fresh seafood, shrimp, crabs, and fish. And we used to sell live chickens, in fact. And a guy came to my facility and had this guy from somewhere out in the country, I don't know where he came from, had this little pickup truck with about 40 sacks of crawfish, and I said, man, I says, I used to eat those when I was a youngster, like you wouldn't believe. He said, yeah, I know. People are trying to eat them now, but not, mostly in the country, the Cajun people. It was from the country, you know, trying to sell them in New Orleans. People didn't want them, they didn't know. And he says, well, he says, why don't you try a few sacks? I says, how much are they? He says, oh, 10 cents a pound. I said, well, how big are the sacks? 40 pounds. I said, you want me to give you $4 for a sack of crawfish? You must be crazy. We used to get those things for nothing. said, well, well, man, he says, try it out. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll leave you 10 sacks here and, you know, consign them. And then if you do not sell them, I'll pick them up. So what I did is I took the 10 sacks. It was, I could, like today, a vivid, vivid, vivid memory. I said, okay, what am I going to do now to sell these damn crawfish? But I'm going to find out. So I got two little kids, about 12, 13 years old, one, and we were on Broad Street, very live, live street, a lot of traffic. I tied a crawfish on the end of the string on the crawfish pole, on the fishing pole, and on one side of the neutral ground going east, I had a kid two blocks away, and the other side of the neutral ground going west, two blocks away. So we're catching the traffic both ways. These kids with this fishing pole had these crawfish dangling on it, you know, and people were, was a really attention getter. Man, what the hell is this? And a little kid would say, oh, down there, Broadview Seafoods, they got these crawfish here, they're selling them. And these people were coming from every direction. And they were buying like 10 pounds, 15, 20 pounds. They didn't know what the hell to do with them, but they were buying them. I sold a whole 10 sacks that day. So I called this guy up. I said, hey, I said, tomorrow, Saturday, bring me 20 sacks. He says, no, he says, we don't fish on Saturdays. I said, Monday. Not Monday either. I said, well, when do you fish? He says, we start on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and Friday. When they got to the next Friday, I told him to bring me 25 sacks. And he says, I can't bring you 25, I can bring you 20. I said, that's fine. So every week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I'd get the max from him for like the first 5 or 6 weeks. And I got tired of this guy not being able to supply me. So one morning I knew where he lived. I went to his house at 5 o'clock in the morning and I waited until he got in his truck and I followed the guy. The guy went to a place called Bayou Pigeon, and he went to a little corner bar. It was just making daylight. And he came out the corner bar, and I said, okay, that's where he's getting his crawfish. I said, fine. So I go down this road, and I see this little old man, little Cajun man. I said, hey, cousin. I said, you fish crawfish? He said, oh, yeah. I said, what about that guy down over there at that barroom down there? Oh, he said, that's my nephew. I said, your nephew? Yeah, he says, he buy all the crawfish. I said, well, how much he pay y'all? He said, he pays 2 cents a pound. I said, he does? I said, well, I'll tell you what. You have some relatives that you can get the fish from me, and you could buy them from them for 2 cents a pound? Oh, yeah. I said, well, you go ahead and buy them for them for 2 cents a pound, and I'll give you 3 cents a pound. The American way of life. You see, the American way of life. That was the inception of crawfish, here we come. Here crawfish comes. So through the years, I was selling these crawfish at the beginning just live. And it got to a point where I'd have some left over. And I wasn't able to sell them. So I told my brother, what we're going to do? Well, he says, we know how to boil crawfish. We know what spices to put in the crawfish. We know how to season them. Let's go ahead and boil some crawfish when we have some left. So I went to the junkyard and I got 4 big heaters out of these big boilers, the biggest one they had, and put me 4 burners together and ran the gas. I knew how to do all that. And I started boiling crawfish. And the first crawfish that I boiled, believe it or not, I sold them 4 pounds for $1, 25 cents a pound. I was the only guy that was bringing them around. At that time, there was only one television station, and it was WDSU. I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on media. I was on TV all hours of the night, all hours of the day. I was on TV, radio, whatever. I did believe in spending money on media. And I know for a fact that the most important thing you can buy in your life is your name. That's the part. And that's the reason why I'm successful in everything I do. I was also in the recording business. Well, I wrote a song first. And from that song, I took the melody. And from that melody, I wrote a jingle. And now there are so many people using my melodies, I can sue NFL because they're using my melody. There are about four or five other people out there using that melody, and it goes like this. Down in Louisiana where the crawfish grow, there is a new thing that you ought to know. While Scaramouza is the crawfish king, baby, watch him do his crawfish thing, doing the crawfish. And it goes like this. And from that came the Seafood City commercial. Seafood City, very pretty. Seafood City, very pretty. Everything is pretty down at Seafood City, down on Broad and St. Bernard. Seafood City, 1826.
The king of crawfish, Al Scaramouza. That Al Scaramouza can really put you in the mood for eating some crawfish. Actually, I'm always in the mood to eat some crawfish. Currently, my favorite way to cook crawfish is in a real Louisiana-style risotto. Risotto is a classic Northern Italian dish that breaks all the rules of conventional rice cookery because it's stirred during the entire cooking process. If you stirred your pot of Louisiana rice, you'd end up with gluey, sticky rice, something nobody around here wants. But risotto is prepared with a special kind of short grain rice called arborio, named for the town where it's grown along the Po River in northern Italy. When cooked, arborio remains firm yet creamy and chewy due to its higher amylopectin starch content. Risotto is one of my favorite comfort foods, and it's really easy to prepare once you get the hang of it. I melt butter with a little olive oil and then add a chopped onion and sauté it until it's translucent. The arborio rice goes in next and is also sautéed until the grains are well coated and a little translucent too. Then, here's where the crawfish come in. Traditionally, risotto is cooked with a combination of stock and wine. To cook my crawfish artichoke risotto, I simply empty a bag of crawfish tails and rinse it out with a cup of water to get every bit of that crawfish fat goodness. The crawfish rinse is added to the wine and stock, along with the liquid drained from a can of artichoke hearts. Together, those different flavors permeate the rice grains as they cook. Add about a cup of liquid to the sautéed rice and start stirring over a medium heat. As the rice absorbs the liquid, add more, about a cup or so at a time, stirring constantly. Suddenly, about 30 minutes into the stirring, the rice will be slightly chewy and ready to eat. Add the crawfish tails and chopped artichoke hearts, then stir in some Parmesan cheese and season with salt and black pepper. Delicioso! That's Italian for yum. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org and itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and crawfish artichoke risotto is real Louisiana Eats. Oh, my baby. Now here's our musical interlude from the Southern Food and Beverage Museum with our Bayou gal, Jenny Merrill.
You get a line and I get a pole, sonny. You get a line and I get a pole, babe. You get a line and I get a pole and we'll go down to the crawfish hole, sonny, babe of mine. Now what you gonna use for the crawfish bait, honey? What you gonna use for the crawfish bait, babe? What you gonna use for the crawfish bait? I use a smelly old shoe and a roller skate, sunny babe of mine.
If all that chicken talk at the start of the show made you hungry for a little yard bird, when we come right back, we'll answer the eternal question, how do you roast a perfect chicken? Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you roast a perfect chicken? First, make sure you've got the right chicken. That would be one that weighs 4 pounds or less. Next, salt the chicken well inside and out and put it in a roasting pan. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees and place the chicken in the center of the oven. Your chicken will roast in about an hour, and you'll know it's done when you can poke it and the juices run clear. Your instant read thermometer should read 170 degrees when inserted into the thickest part of the thigh. Once the chicken's done, put it on the carving board and let it rest for at least 10 minutes before carving it. The resting allows the juices to settle properly and not all run out the minute you slice into the bird. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Every May, the Birdfoot Festival brings to New Orleans electrifying performances of chamber music with a distinctly local flavor. One of their annual events, a musical feast, has Birdfoot musicians joining forces with local chefs for a night of food and live performances. Last year, Chef Susan Spicer provided guests with a mouth-watering menu that included braised duck with blueberries, sweet potato spoon bread, and crawfish bisque with stuffed heads. Producer Joe Schreiner joined the artists both on stage and in the kitchen and sent us this postcard.
Watch my bow, ready? Last 3 bars. 2, 3, 4. Opa, better.
I'm Jenna Sherry. I'm the artistic director of the Birdfoot Festival, and we are on the 52nd floor of Place St. Charles in the gorgeous offices of Jones Walker, who have been incredibly generous to host this event here. And the incredible thing about this place is it has nearly a 360 view, at least a 180 view of New Orleans. And you can see the lake. It's clear enough today we can see all the way to the lake and the curves of the river. And it's just one of the most beautiful romantic spots I think I've been to. So we're here in this beautiful setting for a musical feast, which is the Birdfoot Festival celebration of food and music and community, and a way for Birdfoot Festival supporters to come together and have a great evening celebrating chamber music and kicking off the 2014 festival. And I think something for me as a musician that's very important is that if I'm not eating well, I find it very hard to be creative if food's not good. And occasionally I've been to festivals where the food was really terrible and I found it really depressing. And I know a lot of musicians feel similar, that when there's good food, it nourishes something inside you that then you can turn into creativity and music. And I think Birdfoot believes very, very deeply in this, that in order to produce great art, and that two things bring communities together, and food and music are two of the big ones.
My name is Susan Spicer, and I'm chef owner at Biona Restaurant and Mondo in New Orleans. The way I got involved with Birdfoot is I read about it in the paper the first year, And I just thought it sounded like a really kind of a classy thing for New Orleans, you know, and I like the international quality of it. So I reached out to them and just said, you know, if in the future I can do anything, let me know. And then they asked me to be the chef last year, and the timing wasn't right. And I talked to Steve from Koshan, Steve Strzyzewski, and he was great and said he would love to do it, and did, of course, a fabulous dinner for them. It's kind of neat because they did it last year outside, and so he did the whole hog. And this year with our, you know, our different surroundings, a little more urban and everything, it seemed good to do more of a plated dinner and, you know, less, I guess, picnic-y or whatever.
I was just asking if this was going out or if it was for
sure. I'm Casey Jardina. The restaurant Mondo that I work at in Lakeview is actually 3 or 4 blocks from my house. Asked for a job and got one. I've been working there ever since. So that's how I got in with Susan. I'm by no means an artist, but I feel like cooking and, you know, making plates beautiful and presentations and putting the final plate out and making it look beautiful, I definitely think that's honing my craft.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to invite you to find your seat so we can begin preparing for the fantastic meal and concert that we're about to enjoy.
What's it like before we go on stage? I would say we're always jittery. There's always that expectation, and the audience is waiting, and the most nerve-wracking part is just before. And you sort of think, oh, you know, maybe I should practice this last part, or I should look at this, and then there's a certain point at which you realize it's too late, and that's actually a really liberating, beautiful thing. And there's that moment where you look at the group and you say, all right, let's just go make music. And then you walk out, and all that matters at that point is communicating with the music to the audience.
Lead us off.
Yeah.
Ready, guys?
First movement of Haydn's String Quartet, Opus 20, number 2.
When you look at the books or the reservations as they're known, when you see that it's just going to be slammed, I mean, the ritual is just communication with everybody. Talk, talk, talk. You know, if you need something done, don't wait till the last second. You need to speak up and tell someone. You get nervous beforehand, but once you're actually doing it, when you're really busy, you're too busy to even know that your nerves are there.
Sure, where's the salt?
Right here.
Okay.
Gotcha.
And then start plating.
Chef Spicer and her support team, they really have to work very closely in the way like we do. I think they almost have to be, you know, they have this sort of chamber music experience of their own in the kitchen, this very close teamwork.
Well, it's interesting. It's a little bit more elegant. You know, usually I think of myself as kind of a coach, you know, I kind of almost more of a sports analogy, maybe because we yell more or something. I don't know. But, you know, I've always thought, well, okay, you know, so here's somebody who has played the game but doesn't actually play anymore, but, you know, knows how to get the best out of each part of their team, you know. So I think it fits, you know, all the way across the board, you know, to a conductor and in trying to make the whole, you know, harmonious and get each, you know, get the best out of each individual performer.
This year's musical feast is Tuesday, May the 26th, and features Chef Kristen Essig of Mobar. For more information on that event and the Birdfoot Festival, visit birdfootfestival.org. The word pop might mean music, soda, or your dear old grandpop, depending on where you're from. But if you're John Peterson, the word pop means all three. John is the co-founder of Swamp Pop, a craft soda company based in Lafayette. And when I heard about all the fizzy treats he was making, I just had to get him into our Louisiana Eats studio. John, how in the world did you decide you wanted to go into the soft drink business? One of the things I think is really fascinating is we've got, people who are popping up breweries all over the place. We've got distilleries coming up all over the place. But you are pretty unique in soda pop.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a long history of soda pop in this country, but over time, it sort of became a commodity item, and it was less of a craft item. And we've seen the craft idea come back for food, come back for beer. And over the last few years, as people have been migrating towards the use of real cane sugar in sodas and actually demanding that that craft quality be there, we thought there was an opportunity to kind of take that approach into the soda realm.
And it's a family business, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Explain everybody in the business okay. and what their role is.
Yeah, sure. So we're a very kind of small, close-knit operation. I founded the company with my best friend, who's also happens to be my first cousin, Colin Cormier, also with the help of both of our parents. So it's very much a family business. We growing up, we functionally were a lot more like brothers than cousins, really. And as soon as we were at the age where you start thinking about, what am I going to do with my life, we always thought it would be cool if whatever that was could be something together.
Uh-huh.
When we kind of coalesced around this concept and this idea, aside from it making sense on its own, it was just a great chance to do something with your best friend, and that's been great.
Now, going back to a little bit further about the inspiration for this, you sort of went back to your childhood to think about what flavors and what you wanted the soda pop to taste like.
Yeah, it's neat, you know, when I stop and think about how full circle this whole concept became. Our great-grandfather had a farm. He passed away a couple years ago, but he had a farm in Scott, Louisiana, which is just outside of Lafayette. And he had a great big garden that, you know, we spent countless hours on as kids. He was growing strawberries and figs and cucumbers and watermelons and all these great things. So I think it really helped when we came up with the concept and we knew we wanted to use Louisiana sugar and support that industry. Once it came time to think about what sort of flavors do we want to use to represent our state and represent this concept fully, a lot of that was going back to those flavor memories that we had growing up on the farm. And that's what triggered our realizing, you know, people haven't done this with soda. Louisiana has this incredible culinary heritage, and expressing that through soft drinks has been kind of few and far between. So that's what we wanted to do with these.
But John, with all this flavor talk, I think we should taste some Swamp Pop. How about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best way to know what we're about. Let's taste them. Okay, so the question is, how do we start? Which one do we start with? And I think we're going to start with Jean Lafitte ginger ale, which is a cucumber ginger ale. Okay, here, give that a shot.
Oh my gosh. It's my guess that there's a lot of mixologists that are absolutely going crazy with this.
Yeah, they are. The mixology community has been really great, particularly with the ginger ale, which is really versatile. And then we've also seen this great response from the chef community.
Really?
They're doing really interesting things, marinades, braises. It's been really neat to see what they come up with. We actually last spring did a couple of dinners. We did a short dinner series around Lafayette where chefs used the sodas in each of the dishes, and then the mixologists created cocktails that paired with them using the same soda. And it's been amazing to see what chefs can come up with when you give them this new ingredient that they haven't thought about before. So moving right along, let's go now to the Ponchatoula Pop Rouge, which is our seasonal. It's out right now. It's a limited edition. All right, I love all my children equally, but this is my favorite right now.
ooh, it is some strawberry. I can catch that before I even taste it. Oh, that's delicious. You know what I really like about it? It's, of course, sweet, but it's not cloyingly sweet like so many strawberry-flavored things can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot like with the Satsuma Fizz, we wanted it to be sweet, obviously, but we didn't want it to go too far in the direction of candy. We really kind of wanted to, as much as we could, stay with the the true flavor of the fruit that we were using there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And what's left?
Okay, so now we're going to go to our Noble Cane Cola. So this is kind of what we developed. We felt like any line of sodas should have a cola that kind of grounds it. Cola is sort of the original soda. So we wanted something that was herbal, old-fashioned, almost medicinal in a good way, kind of a cola for grown-ups. So this is our take on that. So you'll find with this one, too, a nice head. And then we also use a little bit of the flavor of Louisiana figs, the brown turkey fig, which is the fig most commonly found in Louisiana. And that'll give it a kind of a sweet finish on the end that's a little unique from other colas.
Oh, my gosh. Figs are my favorite thing in the world. And I can totally taste the fig. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely addictive.
Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you so much. Yeah. This one, you know, over the long haul has been my favorite. I'm a big cola fan. And while right now my affection is with the Pop Rouge because it's new and exciting, this is kind of my standard go-to. And I think it grounds our line nicely and kind of roots it in what we're about as a brand.
How exciting. And, you know, I really love you. Y'all are over in the Lafayette area. That's where you come from. That's where your roots are. And you've got really sort of a triple entendre going on here with the name because, mm-hmm. of course, Pop is soda pop. And then there's the inspiration of your great-grandfather, Pops.
Yep, Pop. Yep.
And now you've also got Swamp Pop,
yep.
which is also a music genre. What made you all decide to call it this? How did all that come together?
Well, we saw the use of Swamp Pop as a kind of a double entendre nod to the combination of pop as a soda pop and Swamp Pop as the indigenous music that started in the 50s in Cajun country, which is kind of a rock and roll, Zydeco Cajun mixture. So we just thought when we combine that with the idea of using Louisiana cane sugar and the rise in popularity of real cane sugar sodas, that it was a name that would maybe jump off the shelves at people and if nothing else, create some curiosity. And then we felt, you know, okay, if we can make really great products that can back up that curiosity, then maybe we'll have something special here. So hopefully that's what we've done. You know, if people are drawn to the name, if nothing else, then once they try them, we hope that they'll enjoy them and realize that it's, you know, a serious product that we've made really carefully.
Well, I can't imagine anybody who loves sodas of any sort to not be thrilled and delighted with these flavors. Come back and see us anytime.
Absolutely. I'd
so
love to.
Let's have a toast. Cheers. Here's to Swamp Pop.
Cheers. Thanks so much. It's been fun talking.
John. Thanks. John Peterson of Swamp Pop.
Well, I went to see my baby last night. She started kissing me and squeezing me and holding me tight. I said, take it easy, greasy. Take it easy, greasy. Take it easy, greasy, because you got a long way to slide. Said, hold me, daddy, and don't let me go, because I want to rock and roll with you some more. I said, take it easy, greasy.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we talk with the 2015 James Beard Award winner for Best Chef of the South, Alon Shaya.
You know, you don't do this to become rich. You don't do this to become famous. You do this because you enjoy bringing people happiness through food and hospitality.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickey Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.